Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on this land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. I would also like to pay my respects to everybody around the continent that is taking our program via the National Indigenous Radio Service NIRS, or if you're tuning in via our app, 98.9 FM for the best country. You can also catch us via our website. Oh, really quickly, you can download that app for free, so please do so. You can also catch us via our website where this program is podcasted. That's 989fm.com.au. Follow the links. Follow the links to the podcast, and you can listen to previous Let's Talk programs. You can also catch us on Spotify and Apple Podcast. Those platforms beaming us into your communities. And as always, it is great to have your company. I've got a really good conversation on the show this morning. It's one that I've wanted to have for quite a while with this guest, but or even one of our previous Let's Talk hosts, Amy McGuire, who was one of the co-hosts of Curtain, which is an amazing podcast and a story. But what I wanted, just before I get into my guest, there's an amazing movie that was put on Netflix. I believe it was last year or the year before. It was called When They See Us. It was about, formerly they were known as the Central Park Five. After this miniseries, they were known as the Exonerated Five, where five young black and brown boys from New York were convicted of a crime that they did not commit, and served several years in juvenile detention and also adult prison in the United States, in America. The reason why I talk about that as well is because the wrongful conviction is a phenomenon, not just in the United States, but around the world. And that's the reason why I want to talk about this podcast. And I'm very delighted to have this guest on the program, on the program this morning. I'll let you know where you can listen to this podcast at the end. But first, I'll introduce my guest, Martin. Good morning. How are you going?
Morning, Bo. Morning, listeners.
Just before we go any further, tell us a bit about yourself, where you're from, and what you do, please, Martin.
Yeah, Walawani, everyone. Yuenthawa Garang from down the far south coast of New South Wales. I'm the senior advocate at an organisation called Foreign Prisoner Support Service, and we're a human rights organisation that provides legal and other supports to people who are detained right around the world in prison, whether they be on death row, the wrongfully convicted, political prisoners, and also do a lot of work with mob in Australia, in every state and territory.
Thank you for that. I'm sure you were listening just in my intro. I was just sort of recounting the film When They See Us, an amazing film, a hard film to watch. I dare say that, you know, before that film, not many of us would have understood the phenomenon, I guess you could say, the wrongful conviction of innocent people, and especially I think people of color or Indigenous people around the world. When did it become aware to you that people were getting incarcerated, but they were innocent, and they were serving long sentences, or even, I guess, in some cases, the death penalty?
Yeah, look, I think for me it really probably started at a really young age. Just we didn't have TV or anything, living out in the bush in a tent, and listening to Dad's stories about what he'd seen and heard, and listening to the radio, which we did every night, and listening to stories from around the world. And then as I started to get a bit older, just for whatever reason, I was always interested in issues around prisoners, people inside. And, you know, you start to hear people get out and say, you know, they hadn't committed the crime, or you read bits and pieces about things that have happened. And it just sort of snowballed from there for me. I think very early on, I always had these doubts about the way police interacted with people. I think I took my first ride in a police car at 4 or 5 and start to question, you know, how can every single one of these convictions be right when there's so many doubts being offered up by whether you're people you know or people you hear on the radio. And it was just an issue I was always aware of. And then before I'd even finished uni, I was just watching TV, and there was an Australian in prison overseas, and no one was willing to help him. He was claiming he was innocent. He was actually a Uyghur man, and we know the persecution they are facing in China currently. And I rang his family and said, look, I'm a student, I don't really know anything, but if I can help you, say the word. And he became my first client, and we were able to prove he was innocent and bring him back home.
Well, and if you don't mind me asking, how long ago was that?
So that was August 2001. So it was an interesting time in the world, because he'd been charged with terrorism just a month before the September 11 attacks. And so what went from still a very difficult case went to an almost impossible one after 9/11, and terrorism became a real thing. So I'd sort of inadvertently and through complete naivety jumped into the deep end without even knowing. And quite a few of my earliest cases were Australians locked up overseas in a range of countries accused of terrorism. So, yeah, we're going back best part of 20 years now.
Yeah. And is this, you know, before you took the first case on, or when you found out about this on the news, is this sort of where you wanted to sort of be in the position to sort of fight for, you know, people who are wrongfully convicted or who are on the death penalty?
Yeah, I think there was something about the death penalty in particular, also prisons in general. My mum had worked doing prison support when she was very young. So it was an issue I'd heard. She'd done work in Victoria in women's prisons. My grandfather had done the same. He'd done a lot to set up a charity to care for those who were experiencing drug withdrawal when they entered prison. So those sort of issues were always close to me. But look, I can't say I had a straightforward plan. It just sort of happened. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't one of those people who thought, I'll go to uni, do this, and it will lead to being able to do this sort of work. I just knew I wanted to be able to help people in this situation. And I guess I just seized that first opportunity that came along.
It's amazing sort of how life sort of pushes us sort of in certain directions, whether we know we want to sort of be within that sort of space or in sort of, you know, like for me, for myself, you know, I never thought I'd be on radio. For people who, you know, I'm quite shy, but, you know, people who know me might not say that I am, but, you know, I'm, yeah. And you know, like, almost 7 years later, I'm hosting sort of a national show on 98.9 FM talking about First Nations issues. And it was just sort of, you know, I just never ever thought, yeah, it's just weird how life works sometimes. You know, we're talking about, you know, the early 2000s. And, you know, we're talking about a time where, you know, this is around September 11th, you know, and if you're sort of a certain minority within this time, you're very marginalized. You're discriminated against, not just sort of in any pockets of the world, but, you know, globally, you know, Muslims and, you know, people of Middle Eastern appearance were sort of discriminated against the world. The world over. Did you encounter working with any people that may have been sort of Muslim or Middle Eastern around this or after this time as well, and sort of looking at, you know, how they were discriminated against because of their appearance? And
yeah, absolutely. One of my earlier cases was an Australian guy, Talal Adri, who was living in Iraq. And he was from a persecuted indigenous group called the Badoon, whose land basically crosses the border between Iraq and Kuwait. And they're a stateless people and they don't have citizenship in either country. And they're treated shockingly in both countries. And he was working there basically selling used cars. And when the Iraq war kicked off and there was all of this stuff about terrorism as well, he was arrested with trumped up charges. And it was really a similar situation to the first case I'd had, where he was, what was happening to him was being shown on the news. The Australian government was doing nothing to help him, even though he was an Australian resident and had come here as a refugee. There was no support for him anywhere. So again, I just sort of rang the family, and still wasn't out of uni at that stage, but it was just so glaringly obvious that this guy had done absolutely nothing wrong. And as I began to speak to the family, there was more and more coming out about the persecution of these people. Their leader was severely in prison and had his back broken by the authorities in Kuwait. And so it became this really urgent situation to get Talal out of prison in Kuwait. No support from the Australian government. And then his torture began, and he was having his fingernails removed and to try and force him to confess to something he didn't do. And I guess, you know, as much as I was aware of issues around forced confessions and torture, that was my first sort of hands-on experience. And not only that, but just how little care there is anywhere, really, in the community, to be perfectly honest, or in government, anywhere. And so I ended up in Canberra at Parliament House, sort of banging on doors. And it was only Natasha Stott-Despoja, the then Democrat senator, who was even willing to speak to me. And, yeah, from there she introduced me to a lawyer in South Australia and we got to work. He was sentenced to death on trumped-up charges, and we were able to get him home in a couple of years. And, yeah, he's back living in Sydney. And that was another real boost, I think, too, to prove to me that it's something we could do from Australia. We could help people wherever they were in the world. And, you know, we could take on governments like Kuwait. And obviously they were being heavily backed by the United States at the time, who needed their air bases for their war in Iraq. And, that, you know, we could prove the truth of these cases. And obviously that's a huge thing, not just for freeing a person, but for everyone around that person too, because I think one thing that's not always understood is with wrongful convictions, sometimes the families begin to doubt their own loved one. Sometimes their friends, their community, and people become very isolated when they're in prison. Not always, but particularly when they're accused of heinous crimes, even when they haven't done them.
And you can see that, like, in that film, When They See Us, you could see sort of the, you know, like the parents sort of believe in the children, but then sort of the outer circle of the family and the friends sort of like, oh, wait a minute, like there may be a possibility that this is true. And but that's sort of like, you know, only the first time I've ever sort of seen something like that in this documentary. If you are just tuning in to Let's Talk, my guest Martin Hodgson this morning is on. He is a journalist and human rights defender who works as a senior advocate with the Foreign Prisoner Support Service, and also the co-host and host of Curtain, an amazing podcast that I want to get to very, very shortly. Martin, I just want to take a quick break and then come back after that. It is amazing conversation that we are having. I just want to play a quick song and then come back. You are listening to Let's Talk here on Murray Country, 98.9 FM.
Are you experiencing flu-like symptoms and need to get tested? We've got respiratory assessment clinics across southeast Queensland that we've set up for MOB. Our clinics provide free parking and easy access to our facilities. And because we're taking bookings, there's no waiting around when you arrive. It's as simple as arrive to your appointment, getting your test done, and going home to wait for your results. No referral is needed. If you've got any flu-like symptoms, no matter how mild, make sure you call one of our respiratory clinics directly to book an appointment. To find your nearest one, visit www.deadlychoices.com.au/healthchecks.
A message from the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health.
Station sponsor.
Someone I ain't never seen before to say he's a captain of men, but ain't believing our love. From the land of the white skin, he's self-righteous, a murderer without license. With the spear, I'm the nicest, thinking that I might just wait till night hits. Then I move in silence, when the moon at its highest, and my soul is defiant. I'm consumed by desire to kill. Any white devil wanna test my will, then he finna get burnt by the fire I feel. Look him in the eye and hold his spirit still. He's hoping I don't catch him, but I know I will.
Stand on the shoreline, Cooperman coming. Might not wanna cross mine, wanna take it from me. Fire in my eye, but we ain't running. Wanna murder, let's ride, yeah, yeah. Stand on the shoreline, Cooperman coming. Might not wanna cross mine, wanna take it from me. Fire in my eye, but we ain't running. Wanna murder, let's ride, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they say that they came in peace, but our blood still stains the beach. Roll the dice, we gon' play for keeps. This sacred place ain't a place to preach.
No, no, no.
No white faith and a black belief.
No, no, no.
Better pray that our spears don't reach. He's cold, white, hot, I'ma make it bleed. Leading to the first fleet, sicker than disease that he bring from overseas. No matter where you flee, I will always be. In the darkest of night, your descendant will see me.
Stand on the shoreline, come
on.
Bugger! Bugger!
Rose Birram with Let's Talk.
And that was Birds and Brother Fred at Leone with that amazing song. I do apologise because I don't want to butcher the name of that. I know I will. I was getting intimidated just looking at the spelling of that as well. But that is an amazing song. Please check out their music. Fred is an amazing artist, a rapper, been around for decades. One of the pioneers of First Nations hip hop in the early 2000s, maybe even like late 90s, considering how old some of his mob are and some of the how long they've been in the scene for. But on the show this morning, I've been chatting with Martin Hodgson, who is a Yuin man, a journalist and human rights defender who works as a senior advocate with the Foreign Prisoners Support Service. We've been yarning a bit about some of the cases that Martin has picked up over his working life or his working career. And he works in the space of freeing people who have been wrongfully convicted and fighting for the exoneration of people who are on the death penalty or in prison convicted wrongfully. And we've been chatting a bit about that and talking about some of his early cases. What I eventually want to get to in the program is some of the work that he's done to support Aboriginal people here in Australia. And obviously him and Amy McGuire's podcast, Curtain, would love to chat about that. And also last week being a massive week for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people all over the country, on Saturday the 15th was a big week. It was a big day, the anniversary of the Royal Commission to Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, when that report was tabled to Parliament well over 30 years ago in 1991. There was a Royal Commission and the recommendations were supposedly implemented, over 300 recommendations to prevent further Aboriginal deaths in custody. I want to chat about that as well, so I'll try and fit that in before we have to let him head off. But Martin is joining us again. And Martin, before we get onto that, I do want to ask, how difficult was it in your early stage of working to free people who have been wrongfully convicted in other parts of the world? It must be very difficult not to sort of have that, you know, physical sort of relationship with somebody than it is sort of, I guess, over the phone or online trying to help them get their story. Does it make it harder?
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, especially in those early days when the internet just wasn't what it is now. I mean, we were purely reliant on handwritten letters. And in many cases, you're relying on them being snuck into the prison. So in Talal Udry's case, for example, in Kuwait, the only way he was able to communicate with us was to sneak letters out. But even in the work I was doing in the United States, helping people on death row there, it was all writing letters. You're often waiting at least a month for a letter to come back. And when you're dealing with appeals processes and challenges that could be happening really quickly and you're trying to get information from a client, it can be an absolute nightmare. But in many ways, it's not that different to helping a lot of mob who have been inside here for a long time, because so much of the court records that we're dealing with in cases that go back into the 90s and early 2000s, again, they're all on paper, nothing's on the internet. The communication's very difficult. The prisons don't make it easy. To be honest, it's probably easier in the US. You get much more time these days on the phone and email with a client on death row, even in the US, than you do working with mob here. So it is always a challenge, but the one thing about that is that you build very strong relationships with people because when you're writing those letters back and forth, they're never just about the case. So whether it was, you know, Troy Davis, who I was working with in Georgia, Tookie Williams in California, who had a lot of support from people like Snoop and Jamie Foxx and Winnie Mandela, you really learn a lot about their lives too. And sadly, both those men were executed. But, yeah, enormous teachers about life and what it's like, what that prison experience is like, and how they sort of came to be where they were. And so much goes back to very similar experiences here of constant police interaction from the time they could remember. And so it really sort of trained me up for what I would go on to do here.
And just for people as well, I didn't realize your work with Tookie Williams. It's pretty amazing. For people listening, Tookie Williams was a member or a founding member of the famous Crips gang in LA. Wrote some successful children's books to deter young kids from getting involved in gangs in LA and around the world. And as you mentioned, you know, made some very, very powerful friends, from Snoop to Winnie Mandela. I believe, like, Winnie actually went and visited him, I think. And I forgot what year it was, but Jamie Foxx played him in the movie Redemption, which is an amazing movie. That's the first time I ever found out about who Tookie Williams was. I think I was a young teenager when I watched that, and it was an amazing film, and sad to see him pass away. And I believe, like, he passed away under when Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor as well.
Yeah, that's right. And it was a very sad time because he had gained a lot of support. He was doing work.
And he was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, that's right?
Yeah, nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, was helping a lot of young people. He was able to run programs from death row, helping young people exit from gangs and find a new path in life. He was, you know, just by telling his story, because he was from those streets, and, you know, everyone had stories about Took and the guys he'd grown up with, Big U and a lot of others, and he was able to connect with young people and was changing lives, and for absolutely no reason whatsoever, Schwarzenegger went ahead with the execution when he could have and wanted to spend the rest of his life dedicated to helping young black kids find their own positive path in life. And again, you know, it's very similar to a lot of what happens here, is that people's ability to serve their community and want to give back is completely stolen away from them needlessly.
Well, I guess let's sort of talk about that now in this part of the interview. As I mentioned throughout the show this morning, you and your co-host Amy McGuire have an amazing podcast called Curtain, which is about Kevin Henry, an Aboriginal man from North Queensland who was wrongfully convicted. Could you tell us a bit about that story and how you sort of come about making the podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, Amy was sitting in the chair you're sitting in at 98.9 and asked to interview me about a case I was doing in America and still working on, Rodney Reed, on death row in Texas. And after we finished the interview, she sort of finished the show and then called me back and said, look, there's this guy in Rockhampton Prison, and Amy grew up in Rocky. The case sounds really similar. He's been inside for 25 years. Do you think you could just have a look at it? And, of course, I wanted to have a look. And, I mean, within a day or two, it was clear that the trial was a complete sham that had happened in 1991 in Rockhampton. Kevin had been accused of murder. It was obvious reading the transcripts, once I was able to get my hands on them, of the court case, that there was absolutely no evidence against Kevin other than a confession that had been clearly extracted under duress. And this was something, I guess, I was more familiar with, having done a lot of work in the US, where that is a much more understood phenomenon, that people can confess to something they didn't do. And the more we looked at it, the more we could see that during that interview that had taken place back in 1991 between Kevin and the police, turned the tape recorder off multiple times. And you don't need to be Einstein to know what happens when police turn a tape recorder off. And
well, maybe just for our listeners, what's the possibility that could happen when the recording devices get switched off? Because you get, like, obviously you can imagine, but, you know, from somebody who has, you know, worked with people, as you mentioned, where I guess there's been an instance where there has been sort of a confession made, but under duress.
Yeah, so basically what happened with Kevin is very common, which is that straight away he asked for a lawyer and then the tape recording stops for about 3 or 4 minutes and it comes back and now Kevin's saying he doesn't want a lawyer. So that's clear to me that, as in every case I've ever worked on, the police have threatened him and told him, basically, we'll bash you if you ask for a lawyer. The tape recorder goes back on. He's willing to speak, but he's denying that he had any involvement. Tape recorder is off, dead again for a longer period of time. And we now know that during this period of time, police put a gun to Kevin's head. And this, again, is a very common thing, whether it's a physical assault, threats of violence. Often police will threaten a person's family.
You're just starting to fuzz a little bit. The line's just a bit shaky, but I just wanted to sort of, you know, hearing you say that, you know, and maybe, you know, it can relate to listeners, like you only hear these things or see them in movies, but then when you hear first accounts, you know what I mean, from yourself, who have represented many people who tell you these, like it's just sort of, you know, mind-boggling, you know, to actually sort of hear that, you know, these actually do happen and it's just sort of nothing that has happened from afar, you know what I mean, from somewhere else, that it can't be sort of happening in our own backyard.
Yeah, I'd always suspected that it had was happening a lot in Australia. I think by the time I spoke to Amy, I knew that it was going on in Australia. It was just how many people it had happened to. But because it hadn't been exposed so much and still really hasn't in Australia, no one believed it. But because I'd seen it so many times, to me it was just obvious this was just how it happened. And, of course, it turned out to be correct. And even under all that threat that Kevin was facing, having been threatened, having been hit, having had the gun pulled on him, he still really didn't confess to anything. And ultimately the judge at his trial threw out that confession and said that it had been taken in duress. And despite that, despite there being no physical evidence, there was no witnesses linking Kevin. In fact, witnesses said he was nowhere near the crime scene when it took place. Kevin was found guilty. And again, this is so many people say to you when they hear this sort of thing, oh, that can't be true. Well, I've just seen it way too many times for it not to be.
What was sort of, you know, when you come in contact with a mob like this or just people in general, what was sort of their legal representation at the time? Obviously, I'm sure it'd be pretty poor or, you know, or there wouldn't be any. Like, do they get sort of legal representation after sort of there's a supposed confession that that these individuals would give?
Yeah, I think that is probably the most important question and something that hasn't been discussed enough around what happens to mob. In the United States, your representation could be very poor early on, but if you're sentenced to death, that automatically triggers an appeals process, and generally you get new lawyers and they're usually much better. In Australia, you're basically stuck with the first idiot that got you convicted in the first place, and I have no trouble saying that Kevin's lawyer was completely hopeless, and that far too many mob are represented by lawyers who either just don't care or shouldn't be in the job in the first place, and that's whether they get much legal help at all. And I think this is a huge thing we have to tackle. One question we don't often ask is, with so many mob in prison, how many of them are not only innocent but have been sentenced to prison because of the poor representation that they received? And once someone has been convicted in Australia, it is very difficult to overturn that process. Kevin had one appeal. So he was convicted in 92 when the appeal happened the same year, a few months later. The same idiot, hopeless lawyer, ran a useless case that went for no more than about 20 minutes. And that was Kevin's appeals process exhausted. And that meant he would serve the rest of his life in jail. And you know, it comes down to three issues, really. I mean, corrupt and crooked police, a racist all-white jury, and a hopeless lawyer. And look, I think mob know what police can be like. We all know what all-white juries can be like. What we shouldn't, we shouldn't accept any of it, but what to me is unforgivable, given the amount of money that is poured in, is just how bad the legal representation is for far too many mob right around the country.
Oh, it is, you know, and this sort of transitions for the last 10 minutes, I guess, of the program. Let's have a conversation about, the 15th of April was a very significant date for Aboriginal people back in the early 90s and also today who have lost loved ones in custody, in prison, or in police custody. It was the 30th anniversary. It marked the 30th anniversary of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, and when that report was tabled to Parliament in 1991. Very significant date. I saw online you were chatting about wanting to sort of do a Q&A and break down what those recommendations was, the significance of them, I guess the weight behind them to sort of prevent further deaths in custody, because that's what they were that's what they were meant for. And as we look back 30 years later, what we can see is, irregardless if some of these recommendations have been implemented, there still have been 474, I believe, Aboriginal deaths in custody since the Royal Commission. But, yeah, Martin, I'd love to sort of just chat about some of the recommendations and if any have been implemented what are some of those recommendations as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, of those 339 recommendations, some of the easiest ones were implemented straight away, but the ones that really count, whether they be things about the prison system itself and the removal of hanging points, what we have to understand is, I think that far too many people look at the Royal Commission's recommendations as being the total solution. It's not. It is 30 years old and we do know a lot more now. But if you look at the removal of hanging points, still hasn't been addressed. So far too many cells have points inside that cell where a person can suicide from. But what's never discussed is the fact that guards so often supply the sheets for the person to commit suicide and torment the person until they do. And it's a very common phenomenon. So as far as I'm concerned, those guards should be charged with murder. That would be a serious implementation of that recommendation. One of the other recommendations is that all deaths in custody be treated as a homicide first and foremost, and for suicide or it being a medical issue, not to just be presumed from the start. Because one thing we know very early on in, whether it's a murder trial or any death, that if you make presumptions, you don't collect all the evidence.
So can I just ask about that one? So as soon as somebody is sort of presented as a death in custody, it's supposed to be treated as a homicide, is that right, you're saying?
Yeah, that was the recommendation.
Oh, that's the recommendation, yeah. But then, you know, like, and this is just from chatting to a few people, which will sort of be my next question. So after somebody passed away, I guess in suspicious terms, there's the coronial inquest, which determines the manner of how somebody passes away. How within the recommendations then is that sort of considered, you know, like where does the homicide sort of sit in that? Because sometimes, they more so talk about the way that they died, I guess, not necessarily it being, they died due to sort of, being roughed up or, having a knee to the neck or, physical pressure being put on them. And this is just, my understanding, which is very little within this space as well. How do those two things, is there a contradiction with that, or how does that work with the coronial inquest?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point. And one of the problems is that once a death ends up in the coroner's court, it's highly unlikely that the police or corrective services will ever be charged. A coroner can refer the matter to the DPP, but largely the coronial inquest is about how the person died and the sort of medical situation. And it's another area we have to question, because part of the recommendations were that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people should have their own representation, but more importantly probably is that we should be able to have our own pathologist present at the first autopsy. Because if that original pathologist who works for the coroner makes a mistake, then you will never be able to reverse those results. And we know this is a problem because in South Australia, until very recently, for more than three decades, the head forensic pathologist in South Australia had no qualifications whatsoever and was found to have made endless erroneous rulings as to how people had died, both for coronial inquests and in murder cases. He's long since been struck off. Many of the people who were convicted as a result of his work have been freed. One of them who hasn't is an innocent Aboriginal man named Derek Bromley, who's been in prison for nearly 40 years for a crime he didn't commit. And again, this goes to the forensic work and just the medical side of things. So we really need very early on, when someone does die, that it be treated as a potential homicide, that we are able as a community to have our own lawyers present throughout that process, and that we can engage our own independent forensic experts to ensure that the initial autopsies and all that medical work is done properly. Because what people also have to understand is this is all done by the same people who work with the police every day. Throughout this entire system, whether it's justice, health and corrective services or the police and forensic pathology, they all work together. And so we shouldn't be surprised when they find reasons to help their friends or work colleagues get away with the crimes they've committed. It's not some grand conspiracy. It's simply the facts that people need to begin to look at a lot more clearly. And if the authorities aren't worried that that would be exposed, then they should follow those recommendations, that we have lawyers present throughout the process and that we can engage our own forensic experts to question this. which you can do in a murder trial and currently you cannot do in a death in custody. Why not? A murder trial supposedly is seeking to get to the truth, and an investigation into a death in custody is supposed to be doing the same. So if that's the case, then we should be allowed our own forensic experts.
Well, my next question was going to be, then how do you, how come we've never had a conviction against a police officer or a prison guard in the instance of a death in custody? I'm still like just sort of baffled and sort of confused and still, you know, like just trying to get it all through my head as well. But why hasn't there been and obviously, like there's the coronial inquest, you know, sort of seeks to sort of see how the individual, you know, what they died from medically, not necessarily, due to sort of the treatment of them by a prison or police officer. I'm trying to ask the question, how come nobody's ever been convicted for a murder?
I think it goes to this issue of the death not being treated as a potential homicide, because that changes the way you investigate. If you presume, which they are told not to do, that it was a suicide or the person died of poor health, then an investigation runs in a completely different manner. It just seeks to understand maybe what underlying health issues did a person have, what was their state of mental health. If you begin with the fact that this person could have been murdered, then from the day one, it's a very different investigation. And if that investigation is to be done properly, and we're talking about the murder being done by police or corrective services, then we need independent investigators. And we need an expert panel of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who should be overseeing independent investigators, who can be present at the first autopsy and have forensic pathologists, who can analyse the crime scene, who can interview witnesses, who have subpoena powers to interview the police under oath so that they would be charged with perjury if they were to lie about the circumstances. And this all needs to be done very quickly, because what happens is with a coronial inquest, often they take years before they take place. And that gives, just as it would in any other murder case, it gives the offenders a long time to get their story straight, to hide evidence, to do everything they can to get away with it. And that's a big reason we don't see police and corrective services found guilty, is because we don't have that independent investigation going on. And, you know, I think too many non-Indigenous Australians are willing to accept that this goes on in America and throw their hands up and rightfully protest about Black Lives Matter in America and police brutality there. But they don't want to accept that it happens in their own backyard. Well, I hate to tell them, if you live in Newcastle, there's police who have murdered Aboriginal people in that police force. If you live in Brisbane, it's the same. If you live in Sydney, it's the same, and so on and so on. And we are all better off if those people are caught, held to account, and removed out of that uniform, because no one is safe when you've got these sort of people walking the streets with a badge, a uniform and a gun. And given we know the over-policing of, to extreme measures, of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, it's no wonder so many mob are dying. When you have these people who have done it and got away with it, you know, if you look at Kevin Henry's case, as I spoke about, that our podcast focuses on in Rockhampton, those two police officers that did that to Kevin and put a gun to his head continued to serve for years after that. So we really need to ask, how many other people did they do the same thing to? And how many other men and women are in prison in Rockhampton and around Queensland because of those two officers? And we also know their superior officer was corrupt as anything. I mean, that was found by the state of Queensland. How many people did he put away who hadn't done anything, and how many of those people committed suicide or were beaten to death in prison and became deaths in custody. So when we just focus on exactly how the person died, we're missing the bigger picture. How did they get into prison or interact with police in the first place? And very often that's through over-policing and police corruption and brutality in the first place.
And wasn't that sort of a recommendation, was to look at other alternatives to imprisonment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, because they represented a much, and still do, a much higher percentage of the prison population?
Yeah, absolutely. I think prison is, well, I don't necessarily even believe in it in the, the way it's built at the moment, but, you know, I see no reason and no case of an Aboriginal woman in Australia that needs to be in prison, not one, and I would happily review them all. And part of the reason we shouldn't have Aboriginal people in prison is because it's not a safe place for them to be. We're not supposed to have the death penalty in Australia, and yet we have more than 470 mob die in the last 30 years. So until they get their house in order in terms of corrective services, I don't think we should be seeing any blackfellas going inside.
I just want to ask you as well, in the last couple of minutes, I'll try and fit in maybe two questions. One is, you know, from conservative populations here in Australia, they always, when we talk about the issue of death in custody, and I saw it quite a lot actually in the lead up to the 30th anniversary of the Royal Commission, is that, you know, they were, even some blackfellas as well, I saw, sadly, were sort of spouting this whole thing of, what about the non-Indigenous peoples who die in custody? There's, the, you know, and then pulling up whatever the numbers were, saying like that there's more that die in custody than Aboriginal people. Why isn't this as much of a hysteria? As somebody who sort of worked in this space, could you tell us about the significance of this as an issue, as black deaths in custody, and sort of how that sort of weighs up with, you know, non-Indigenous sort of deaths in custody in Australia?
Yeah, look, I think the first thing I would say is I don't know why the non-Indigenous population isn't protesting about the deaths of non-Indigenous people in prison. That's the first thing. I mean, but secondly, it misses the broader point, which is that Aboriginal people are over-policed from very early on. And the reason why Aboriginal people are in prison is often very, very different. It's a lot more to do with failures by government to provide proper housing, education, and all those sort of things very early on, where you see young mob in prison for the most minor of crimes very early. So I think, you know, we need to take, again, a broader look at why is a person there in the first place? And those issues between Indigenous and non-Indigenous tend to differ very greatly. Again, you know, I can't think of a single Aboriginal woman who should be in prison. And I'm talking about in every prison in Australia, I don't know of a single case. And what the recommendations show, and I think one thing we can prove, is that when you put just basic services in place, holistic services that help people, like Sisters Inside, you know, then non-Indigenous people tend not to re-offend at the same rate as non-Indigenous people. So in all my time, I've never had a client re-offend. And quite frankly, that is an indictment on the services that are provided to mob, because what I do is simply follow up with them for as long as it takes, for years, whether that's assisting them with education, getting into basic housing, having their health issues addressed. So a lot of these things come back to providing the basics. And, you know, when we talk about deaths in custody and the numbers between Indigenous and non-Indigenous, we have to understand that for blackfellas, there was never the chance in the first place because of the way the system's set up. So we really need to be serious about what's in place in terms of from very young early childhood education and housing, right through to how good is the lawyer that represents the person on the day and everything in between.
And not to just to mention as well the brutal history of the police force in Queensland and in other parts of the country as well. You know, the Native Mounted Police was a very brutal organisation and sort of had a brutal history. You know, I was thankful enough last Monday to have a chat with Lindley Wallace, who was an associate professor and an anthropologist, and through her work, you know, they were mapping Native Mounted Police camps all over Queensland, different parts, and, you know, their findings found that over 50 years the Queensland Native Mounted Police operated throughout the whole of Queensland. Camps were set up, you know, for decades to a couple of years to a few months, you know, and they were set up to specifically protect the livelihoods, the lives and the properties, you know, of settlers, and to prevent and punish Aboriginal people. And, you know, one of the most astonishing things that I remember chatting to her with was they estimated that about 100,000 Aboriginal people had died in frontier conflicts with the Native Mounted Police. That's not talking about the killings outside of the Native Mounted Police, like the poisonings of the waterhole or dying from diseases and other stuff as well. Like, you know, when I think of Black Death and Custody, that's what I think of, is this sort of continuing legacy of brutalization of our community. Martin, thank you for coming on the program this morning. I have a whole bunch of more questions that I want to ask. We'll have to catch up again sometime soon to continue this show, because it is amazing and it's very much needed, this conversation. So we'll definitely have to make some more time sometime soon to get you back on the program. Hopefully maybe you and Amy can come on and we can have a more broader discussion about the podcast. And just really quickly, where can people go to find it and have a listen?
Yeah, so it's Curtain the Podcast. It's on Apple iTunes, Google Play. There's a website, curtainthepodcast.com. So if anyone just Googles Curtain the Podcast, they'll find it. And anyone who needs assistance, just use the contact details to reach out to me, whether it's questions or if you've got a loved one inside, just hit me up and I'll always do my best to help out.
Awesome. Just for people tuning in, my guest this morning, Ewan Mann, Martin Hodginson, joining me this morning to have a chat about his podcast, Curtain. Also, the amazing work that he has been doing for over 20 years now to support the wrongfully convicted in Australia and around the world. It's an amazing work. I do have to go and Google some more of the work that you have been doing because it's just amazing. Like I said, I've got a whole range of questions to ask as well, so I'm definitely going to try and book you in sometime soon to continue this yarn. And thanks again.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate the time.
And that was Ewan Mann, Martin Hodginson, joining me this morning. Coming up now to finish the show off, going to go out with Dobby featuring Barker, I Can't Breathe. You're listening to Let's Talk on Murray Country 98.9 FM.
Yeah. Sick of having to explain myself. They want to know the history, the pain might help. They're making me wild, need to restrain myself. If I were you, I would educate myself. Oh no. They want me to hate myself, degrade, dismiss, and erase myself. They said Australia and America's not the same. I say David Dungay, they don't even know the name. That's bullshit. Write to your member, tell them what's happening. You gotta challenge the white, settle a narrative. Got a lot of books that call us nomadic savages. Maybe that's a connection to them attacking us. Government thinking up any other solution. But truth leads to treaty and revolution. Killers acquitted, your silence is killing. Give us your platform so your people can listen. First came the massacres, then came the mission. Then stole the children, then filled the prison. No wonder our people do not trust the system. Over 400, not one conviction. Shame!
No justice and no peace. They won't charge the police.
defend. And saying sorry means it never happens again. Some of these cops must have been bullied in PE to kill mob. That's why Kaepernick took a knee. Donald Trump's calling that a lack of respect. But what do you call a knee to the back of your neck, huh? This shit's as bad as it gets. Cause some of these coppers really don't know how to protect. And it's legitimized. See, they try to minimize genocide. And all my Twitter fights. Cause the revolution televised. Yo,
no justice. What? And no peace.
Blame me for it, then expect me to be silent and then thank you for it. I ain't thankful, they've been killing my people by the masses and I'm fed up to the neck by you right-wing fascists. I feel anger when my people feel anger, that's connection. We're angry for a reason, cause our babies need protecting. I'm scared to send them out, cause their color is a weapon. When we walk through the streets, people somehow feel threatened. We only want the system to be civilized. You televise your point of view, then feed the shapes full of lies. You bought the divide when you set up all the missions and you still cause divide, killing my people in prison. I'm sick of it, sick and tired of the thick of it. Show no respect about so-called Australia. Get their knees off our necks.
No justice and no peace. They won't charge the police. They both said, I can't breathe. They both said, I can't breathe. No justice and no peace. They won't charge the police. They both said, I can't breathe. They both said, I can't breathe.
Come on, man. Y'all know what time it is. That's why you out here.
Well, I really appreciate you giving your perspective, mate, because people in Australia don't have the understanding of
the history of police.